Hello, I'm Tika Ballas, and today on Hometown Alaska, we will begin the first of a two-part series on God in Alaska. This show parallels the PBS series God in America, which begins next Monday, October 11th, on KAKM Channel 7. Religion shapes social mores, cultures, and politics. This two-part series is not meant to define and discuss all of the different religions and faiths that have played a part in the history of the state, but rather to inspire a social discourse and to briefly touch on the different aspects of God in Alaska. For the first part of today's show, we will be speaking about the different faiths among the Alaska Natives prior to the introduction of Russian Orthodox missionaries. Speaking with us will be Paul Antaguk. He is a faculty member with the UAA School of Education and founder and co-director of Alaskol, an online site for Alaska Native history, education, languages, and cultures. In the second part of today's program, we will be discussing the introduction of the Russian Orthodox Church in Alaska with Father Michael Alexa. Again, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today's show is the first in a two-part series called God in Alaska, the history of faith in the Great Land and where it is today. If you would like to join the conversation, we'll start taking calls in just a bit at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Good afternoon, Paul, and thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me here.
And let's just go ahead and start off. In my understanding, Alaska, before it was a territory, much less a state, the first people had a faith in a higher power. And can you just briefly describe the differing beliefs and creation theories, possibly?
It's actually daunting to think about it, because if we look at the history of time, about 99+ percentage of the history of Alaska would have encompassed various traditional beliefs, many of which I would imagine have been lost and have certainly been transformed, changed, and changed again over the thousands of years that they've been here. So, and they span dozens of different cultures as well. So it's an amazing task. It's something like asking about the nature of religion in the Middle East today.
Yeah. So would it be easier if we took it closer to the edge just before the introduction of Russian missionaries? Or are there a few that stand out that are still prevalent today?
It's really, today, when I look at this, I think we're all sort of captured by our own histories when it comes to questions about God and the world, spiritual understandings and things. And I have to recall when I was out sealing with my father and his hunting partner. Are both deacons in churches, are members of these Christian-sponsored missionary churches that had become established. But while we were out sealing, once the seal was brought in, without hesitation, without thought, opening a traditional Inupiaq G.I. Joe surplus water canteen, we then poured a bit of fresh water into the mouth of the seal before, as an offering, as a symbol of thanks for the seal giving itself to us. And I have to say that it was, at that point I was finally old enough to recognize, well, how does this reconcile with what the missionaries of the church that they belong to, what would they make of that? And the answer was to avoid the question by not going hunting with missionaries.
So. Oh, and when that comes back to the question, though, in a sense, is you're giving water back to the seal, and it's a way to pay thanks. But what is the predominant creation idea or creation story?
I don't know that we know that. I mean, over the broad span of time, of course. It's been well documented, the role of raven in many traditions in creation, and that's been carefully examined, and I think very respectfully in many instances by modern scholars and folklorists and people who subscribe. One of the things that I think would be true is that there wasn't a substitution of traditional beliefs with the arrival of Christian missions. And instead, what I often see are people who are, to a variety of degrees, trying to reconcile views of the world and a spiritual sense of how do we understand the world as more than its physical makeup? How do we understand the natural world, the human dilemmas, moral questions, and our relationships in society? And these are just complex questions, and they're responded to in a variety of ways. At the same time, traditional beliefs often get sort of caught up with almost satires, because people will say, well, that's just mere superstition, or these are primitive beliefs. And that's one of the things that I think even today drives people to be very resident, hesitant to talk about current sort of traditional practices, beliefs, understandings that are, I think, my sense of it, are pretty widespread even today.
Well, let's go then to the idea of the Raven story. I've heard the Raven story in several different ways, and they are all very beautiful stories. And I understand that they've been categorized as folklore in many ways. But can you share a common Raven story?
In outline, I always hesitate because I sense that the best ways in which these stories, I wrote in an essay elsewhere on akhistorycourse.org, that it's very difficult to sort of capture the intent of these stories, because we often pull them out of the social and family context. It's something like reading a liturgy outside of a church. If you just read it as a document, it conveys something, but it loses a lot because of the missing elements, that context of elders teasing, telling stories to one another, sitting next to each other, sharing food, about which we are then trying to understand this sort of bounty of nature that's supporting our culture, our society. And these stories then are about very real things. And by the time it gets moved into a story that happens in an elementary school or in an anthropology class, it becomes something very different. But nevertheless, you know, there are a variety of stories about Raven helping to capture and share light, heat, fire, the sun, casting of the stars, as a trickster, as a comedian, as a powerful being. And I suspect it's because Raven is a companion in our cultures in Alaska. Raven are incredibly adaptable. They're smart. They follow us. They follow Wolf. They will actually lead Wolf to prey, so that Raven can then benefit from the successful hunting of the wolf. People who study Raven are constantly surprised and overwhelmed by the complex social relationship, the variety of calls that they have, and the intense sense of they've even been captured just being playful, from everything that we can understand. I don't know if you've been there, but I've watched Raven sort of rolling down a snowbank, and you just think, well, there's no practical reason. Perhaps they're getting rid of, you know, something on their wings or whatnot. It mostly appears that they're just having a grand time.
Yeah, it really does. Let's go back to what you mentioned about offering water to an animal. Now, that would almost come across as ceremonial. And surely there are still, even with the introduction of Christian religion, some truly purely native ceremonial things that still go on within different villages and different parts of the state. And I think they're often referred to as religious ceremonies. Can you tell me a little bit about what some of those ceremonies might be or what they mean?
The boundaries of those are, it's hard to sort of draw that clear line of what is a spiritual event and what is living very respectfully as a person, as a part of this sort of this larger thing, in which we're contributors and in which we receive gifts from the world around us, if we're fortunate. And there's a very real sense that what we do is, there isn't a sense that God or a supreme being granted us sort of unitary absolute title to the land, to the world, to the waters, but that instead we are a relatively small part of a much larger scheme of things, and in many ways not even the most important part of that scheme, that sort of vision of the world. And in that sense, I think there's been an ongoing sort of difficulty reconciling that with some traditional, some versions of how Christianity has been conveyed in rural Alaska and in Alaska Native cultures.
It's hard to find the defining line.
Right. Well, you know, what's the difference between, we're in what many people would describe as a Christian society, and you see people, some who hesitate to open an umbrella indoors or walk under a ladder or have a cat walk across in front of them, and you say, well, this must be their spiritual beliefs. And they would say, oh, no, it's just a mere superstition. But their theology may not have any place for it. But then moving on perhaps a little closer, then what's St. Valentine's Day? And where did that come from? And the Feast of Saturnalia and the birth of Jesus and pine trees and Yuletide logs and, you know, just all of these things. And how do you sort out which parts of that is a representative of Christianity as a cultural element, spiritual, traditional beliefs in Western society, and then what is the core beliefs that are essential to these ways of understanding the world? I'm not trying to be difficult or evasive. I'm just trying to point out that it is it is not as simple, because we didn't come up with the Nicene Creed or the, you know, the simple write it on your hand summaries of a lot of these traditional beliefs. There's a clear sense of being grateful, of being a small part of a large world, of being transitory, of making your contribution, knowing that if you act in a foolhardy, proud, arrogant way, that there will be consequence for you, for perhaps your community, and for those around you, that your disposition is a part of your spiritual life.
If you're just tuning in, this is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing God in Alaska, the first in a two-part series, the history of faith in the Great Land and how it shapes us today. If you would like to join in on the conversation or you have questions for my guests, you can give us a call at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Now, there is a story that I did hear years ago when I first moved to Alaska. And it was told to me by an Athabascan man who told me that Creator was Raven, and that Raven created human after all the other animals. And the animals said, why did you create this silly human? It has no wings, it cannot fly, it has no fins, it cannot swim, it has no fur, it will freeze to death and die. And Raven told them, well, tough luck, I created it, now live with it. So they went and had a committee. They came back and said, okay, we've discussed and we have agreed that we will all take turns giving up our lives to ensure that this human creature that you've created can survive. And in turn, they all took turns sacrificing themselves And I was told by this man, I don't know if this is true, perhaps you can help clarify, that there is no word in Athabascan for hunter, that the animals in turn just sacrificed themselves, giving turn to give feather and food and warmth. Are you familiar with this story, or is this just somebody?
Well, I'm Inupiat by background, so I would be the last person to speak about things Athabascan. They're on the other side of the DMZ from, you know, culturally they're friends and trading partners, but we often have a history of conflict over traditional use areas as well. And very proud that they were both trading partners and incredibly impressive opponents as well. We, you know, the sense in the Inupiat community when I grew up was to have opponents of that caliber meant that you had to develop a pretty impressive character and skill in order to compete with them. So, you know, our hats off, but we won't provide linguistic insights. I certainly do want to point out that, you know, if you've been out hunting at all, you know, we can all recognize seal do swim faster. They have better eyesight. Caribou see better than we do, and in a casual gait, they can outrun us. If animal wish to leave us, to escape us, to avoid us, they have all the abilities, the sensibilities to do that. And so then the question becomes, well, then why would they allow themselves to be taken? Mm-hmm. And the answer from a spiritual standpoint is they are giving themselves to people who show profound respect for the gift that is being offered, and that we then share, we make use of that sharing in ways that are understood, and then we return some vital part of that in ceremony, and it comes back. It goes back out. The essential creature then puts on a new garb so that they can return again to share more.
So there is a bit of a similarity, or there is some truth. Oh, I would hesitate to use that word. Let's instead go to the phones. Good afternoon, Don.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
You bet. I have a question for Paul. Paul, this is Don Shackelford. You and I actually know each other. One time, Paul, I was in Chivac with our mutual friend, Dr. McDermott, and I asked him about how was it that people in Chivac, a very traditional Chupik community, where almost everyone was of the Catholic faith, how was it that people of that faith were able to, how was the faith able to incorporate Chupik cosmology into their worldview? And what Bill McDermott said to me was, it's not a question of Catholicism being able to incorporate cosmology, it's the fact that Chupik cosmology, as Bill understood it, was large enough to incorporate Catholicism. And I'm wondering what your thoughts might be around that whole issue of how people, traditional people, incorporate Christian cosmology into their lives along with their traditional beliefs.
Great question, Don.
It's a part of the problem of being one person talking about such a broad, it's both a cultural thing and different religions, it's and different branches of Christianity. But I do think that what we often see is that the missionaries came to share beliefs, and you know, I think of it in the same way that when my dad was a child, there were pictures of him in this sort of bright silver rain parka, and I said, "Why? Where? What was that all about?" And it was from Teller, Alaska, when he was a child, and it turned out that there was an Italian dirigible. You can't make this stuff up. That crash landed. It was the Norge, and after it had done an over the pole exploration trip, and so this amazing football field size quantity of dirigibles material, the cover, was available, and it turns out it makes a great rain garment. And I think of that as the analogy for the face that were brought in as well. They came over, they dropped in, and then people have been making use of them, adapting them. Not entirely, you can't change the fabric itself entirely, but you can change the purpose, the effect, the size, sometimes even the outcome. I'm certain that the manufacturers of the material for the dirigible Norge were not anticipating Eskimo rain garments. And so what we see are these sort of unintended consequences of these interactions.
That's a good question, Don. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to go back to what Don just asked was about traditional, say, Yupik or Chupik villages. What does that mean exactly, to be traditional?
Well, we're still trying to figure that out. I mean, it's the question that people are asking today about what does it mean to be Japanese in a society. You don't have to look like you're a Richard Chamberlain samurai movie extra in order to be really Japanese. But at the same time, kimonos and no dramas and traditional practices and martial arts and, you know, those are, and religious views are a part of it. But at the same time, the Japanese are not considered less Japanese for manufacturing cars, stereos, and participating in modern society. I don't know that most Americans have granted that same perspective to Alaska Natives, that we are trying to do all of this, bring and renew our views about society, about the spiritual world, about the mixed blessings, the decidedly uneven consequence of modern equipment. But at the same time, I think most of us are pretty happy about the germ theory. And any restaurant we go into, we want people to support the germ theory, right? And so, you know, there isn't a false expectation that we have to be, in order to be Native, we have to be pre-contact sort of Edward Curtis prince, but that the realistic question is, how do we carry forward this mixture, this sort of combination, and who gets to decide?
We have been speaking with Paul Antegek, the founder and co-director of Alaska, an online site for Alaska Native history, education, languages, and culture. Next, we will be speaking with Father Michael Alexa of the Russian Orthodox Church, who will discuss the arrival and influence of the Russian Orthodox Church after this break.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Today is the first part of a two-part series titled God in Alaska. I would like to impress upon our listeners that in no way is this two-part series meant to cover everything regarding spirituality, faith, and religion in the Great Land, nor all the different beliefs. This is merely meant to inspire a public discourse and an illumination of some of the different aspects regarding the topic of God in Alaska. Our next guest is Father Michael Alexa. He is a priest with the Russian Orthodox Church. He has been recognized as an elder by the Alaska Federation of Natives, a distinguished public servant by the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska, and honored by the Alaska State Legislature and the National Governors. Good afternoon, Father.
Good afternoon.
Now, I understand there is a bit of controversy regarding the research you have done and your findings, but in your estimation, could you briefly illustrate the introduction of the Russian Orthodox Church to the Alaska Natives, the where and when the missionaries first arrived?
Well, it's, first of all, difficult to discern exactly who the first missionaries were. After Vitus Bering's rather catastrophic voyage and of exploration in 1741, you know, his ship wrecked and he died. The survivors went back to Siberia with sea otter pelts that were something of a sensation on the Chinese market. And it set off for the next 50 years a kind of gold rush, only this was a fur rush, where frontiersmen from Siberia, many if not most of them Siberian native people themselves, came to the Aleutian Islands and traded goods for sea otter pelts. Sea otter pelts were the main focus. But over the course of that first five decades or so, increasingly many of those frontiersmen remained in the Aleutian Islands, intermarried with Unangan women, and built chapels and baptized their own wives and kids. So in a certain sense, the introduction of Christianity in a formal way is almost hidden from view, because this is the first 50 years of Alaska history we actually know the least about. Mm-hmm. Dr. Lydia Black, my colleague at Fairbanks, spent some time in Siberia. It turns out these fur traders had to acquire business licenses in order to legally operate and pay income tax on their profits. And she perused the business license applications, which are still on file in Irkutsk, amazingly, and discovered that one out of three of them were native people of Kamchatka. Another third or so were people of mixed native Russian Slavic backgrounds, and probably only a third of them were what we would today call ethnic Russians. Nevertheless, they introduced Christianity very informally. You know, is exactly what Paul mentioned. It wasn't so much a dirigible landing on the Aleutian Islands, but they were skin boats filled with people who had their beliefs and customs. And even those who stayed longer or intermarried, when it came time for Christmas, gathered together and sang Christmas songs. When it was time for Easter, they gathered together and sang Easter songs. And this was just part of their culture, whether they were Siberian native or Slavic, coming from the other side of the Bering Sea. And these customs were introduced, I would say, rather organically in that first almost hidden 50-year period of contact. But then, of course, we have the conquest of Kodiak, which is a completely different and tragic chapter, where Gregory Shelikov comes with ships armed with cannon. It's no longer going to be free trade for beads in exchange for pelts. You're going to get out there and hunt at gunpoint, and we'll blow up your smokehouses if you don't. So it's a kind of military exploitation and oppression of the Kodiak Aleutic people. But Shelikov, on the other hand, had a very interesting role in introducing the first formal missionaries to Alaska. He wanted a fur monopoly. He wanted to put everybody else out of business. And so he traipsed all the way back to St. Petersburg and appealed before Catherine the Great in person to grant him a monopoly over all commerce in the North Pacific, not just Alaska, but he wanted Japan, Korea, and the Philippines besides. There was nothing sort of humble about Gregory Shelikov's ambitions. Catherine didn't agree to any of his proposals except one, and that was that he fund a mission. He asked for one priest, and she authorized 10 to come to Alaska, specifically to evangelize the Aleutic people. Of course, when he went out to recruit clergy, there weren't any married men with families who wanted to cross all of Siberia and come to Alaska, which hadn't even been mapped yet. The globes of the planet didn't include Alaska because it hadn't been explored or charted. So he went to the largest monastery near St. Petersburg, Valam, and there he recruited 8 monks, men who were living in a monastic life. And he was supposed to provide transportation for them. As far as I know, the main form of transportation he provided were new boots, because they walked 8,000 miles across most of Siberia. And when they arrived in Kodiak in September of 1794, they went into a kind of culture shock when they realized that the oppression and exploitation of the Kodiak Aleutic people was nothing like what they had been led to expect. So we have their first letters back to Valam, their mother house in Finland, in which they describe the religious beliefs of the Kodiak Aleut people and say there's a lot we can work with here. These people already know basically the Ten Commandments. They believe that human beings are all descended from the same original parents. They believe in an almighty creator God, but he's kind of so high up and far away that nobody prays to him because he has nothing to do with our menial trivial everyday lives, but they at least have a name for such a creator. And they also said the Kodiak people had stories of a great flood that had covered the whole earth. In other words, they said, much to our surprise, well, maybe not surprise, but amazement, these people have a lot of beliefs that are already common to us. And then they comment, but that's to be expected. The Holy Spirit goes wherever he wants and can inspire people everywhere. So the original monks, when they came to Kodiak, although they had a hard time with Baranov and his henchmen who were really exploiting and oppressing the Kodiak people, they took the time to hear the stories and analyze the already existing traditional beliefs of the people on that island and started with what they could already affirm and agree with, rather than coming in with a lot of new teachings that would have been in conflict with the local beliefs.
So the question then comes in is that there's an organic change that happens when people come in, as like the fur traders did in the Aleutians, and how different ideas and ideologies are kind of molded into a culture naturally. But with this situation with Baranov, he wasn't so kind to the people already living here. Yet you say that the eight monks that came over took the time to understand, but was there anything organic that ended up happening in that? Or in your estimation, did you find that there was any kind of revolt against some of the missionary work coming over because of Baranov?
Oh, there was definitely a resistance to Baranov. But all reports indicate that what the monks had to say was embraced and accepted. It wasn't so much that they were replacing the beliefs that were already there. They were adding another layer of story. The original stories are still told to this day, both in the Yupik and Tlingit areas as well as Kodiak Aleut. There wasn't any deliberate or conscious attempt to eradicate any of that. In fact, as much as possible, they spoke in favor of retaining that and building on it. The missionaries even sat down and talked shop with shamans, respecting their prophetic and abilities to heal people, and even wanting to know how they got those prophetic powers. There's a wonderful story of Father John Vindeminov out in the Aleutian Islands in the late 1820s, early 1830s, where the shaman has told the people to expect the priest to come, and the people are all waiting for him at a particular bay, dressed in their sort of Sunday go-to-meeting kamalekas, their best clothes. And he's kind of amazed that they would know that he was arriving on that particular day at that particular site. So he asked the Unangan people, how did you know to expect me? And they, oh, our shaman told us. That for them, it was just, of course, you know, matter of fact. And then when he went into the village, he met people the shaman had healed. And then people spoke about the shaman providing them with information on where to find food. And this was all undeniable. The shaman clearly had these powers. So the shaman was summoned. The priest sat down with him and said, you know, how do you know this stuff? And the shaman says, well, I have some spirits that appear to me every day. Two or three of them come almost every day and tell me things. And then the priest asked the shaman, well, what do these spirits look like? And after a lengthy conversation, he concludes that the spirits that are appearing to the shaman are what in Christian or biblical tradition would be angels. And there's nothing that he has to teach these people that would contradict what the shaman has been teaching them and vice versa. So there's this open. Now, that might seem like these Russians had some kind of advanced anthropological sensitivity. I don't think that was the case. I think that the difference between those missionaries who came from Siberia and later ones who came from the lower 48, the main difference was that they grew up among shamanistic tribes. They were living in Siberia, where the majority of the rural population were also nomadic, shamanistic Siberian tribes. And they knew about shamans before they came to Alaska. Americans in the following century who came to Alaska were growing up in places, well, like, for example, Sheldon Jackson grew up in Schenectady, New York. There was no possibility in his boyhood to come into contact with nomadic tribes or shamans. So when he met his first shamans, he jumped to some unfortunate and probably erroneous conclusions that these guys were all bad, that they were all in league with the devil, and that their practices had to be forcibly suppressed and exterminated, really. And shamans were arrested by federal marshals, and the traditional religious beliefs of especially Tlingits were forcibly suppressed by government agents. But it didn't happen in the Russian period, not because the Russians were smarter or wiser, but just because they were coming out of a cultural context that had already informed them about these practices. And so they were far more, I would say, open and tolerant of them, and in fact, even eager to learn about them.
You're just tuning in, and this is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing God in Alaska. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. There is also a list of links to sites regarding religion, faith, and the discourse thereof under Hometown Alaska at www.kska.org. Now, Paul, I've just noticed you shaking your head yes, nodding in agreement. And part of that was when Father Michael was discussing the stories of great floods that were similar, that the missionaries, or the monks, rather, came over and heard stories that were very similar to their own faiths. And are you familiar with these stories that originally?
Oh, absolutely. On the AK, the Alaska School website, we have a print version done, fortunately, by Laura Bland of William O'Quilluck's recording of fragments of our history, and it includes a flood. Many people will read that, and I have them read that in courses, and some people will say, oh, well, he was just cribbing from missionaries who told him this story, and he's making it an Inupiaq story. And one of the things I ask them to do is to then say, well, how is it different than the Genesis story that they typically may have heard? And the difference is there's no moral reason for the coming of the flood. It's not people have done something wrong or offended God or, you know, done anything. It's just going to happen. This is the nature of a catastrophic event in the world. And the real question is, if you were going to anticipate this happening, then what are you going to do? The other thing is, it's not a universal flood. It floods our world. It doesn't flood the entire world. And so you don't have to save a pair of each animal, which from a genetic standpoint would be somewhat unfortunate. So there's this, you know, sense that, you know, what we're doing is that the focus is, what is it that is essential about surviving and continuing and flourishing as human beings together? And the answer is to hold on to caring for one another and to keep the power of imagination. That's the underlying theme about this. It's imagination that drives our spiritual sense. It means we're questioning, we're wondering what if, we're walking around, and our imagination is informed in very rich ways by the world around us, both material and spiritual.
And Father Michael, do you find that there are other stories that keep this imagination alive that were very similar in your findings that were already in place here?
Well, in a sense, to say that one tradition replaces another is kind of inaccurate. I would say there's just simply different layers of ceremony and different layers of story. Probably one of the more well-known but also misunderstood events in Alaska's annual holiday cycle is the Yupik and to some extent Alutik and Unangan celebration of starring. It's called in Yupik Slavic, which is a Russian word. And people who aren't Orthodox, and even some who do, simply call it Russian Christmas. But in fact, if you participate in this 3-, 4-, 5-day period of feasting and visiting and gift-giving on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, it's far more a Yupik celebration than it is anything that you would find in Russia. In pre-contact times, winter was the time for people to gather, to celebrate, to feast, and kind of to hunker down because there's not much you can do. It's so cold and the days are so short. And so traditionally, this was the time for remembering the year past and especially the departed, those who had died. In traditional culture, this included not only the human beings, but the animals as well. The animals who had given themselves, sacrificed themselves to feed the human community. When people started celebrating Christmas at about the same time of year, at least in the Russian era and in the Orthodox villages to this day, they kind of added Christmas caroling to that traditional practice of feasting and celebrating. So people go to church now for beautiful and lengthy Christmas services. They've been translated from Greek into Slavonic and Slavonic into Yupik and from both those languages now into English. So you find a combination in most southwestern Alaskan villages of people singing in one, two, or three different languages, sometimes the same song, just sung once in Russian or Slavonic, once in the local native language, and again in English. And the Christmas star is a uniquely Eastern European custom. It's well known in Ukraine and Romania. In general, it's not known at all in Russia. So starring, if you ask people in St. Petersburg or Moscow or Novosibirsk or Irkutsk about starring, they wouldn't have any idea what you were talking about. So this is another element, another layer of the story and another layer of culture. And the star, in fact, and the folk carols that go with it, which are mostly Ukrainian, we can't trace it back to its origins. We don't even know who brought it to Alaska, both the star and the Christmas carols sung in Ukrainian that go with it.
Now, for our listeners, can you explain the star?
The star is a big sort of pinwheel apparatus with a picture, an icon of the Nativity of Christ in the middle. And people literally follow the star. The star leads the procession from house to house, starting in the church and then usually going to the local rector or priest or deacon's houses, and then from house to house through the village. In my experience, well, in my wife's experience, to go back a generation earlier, people would star in the house for half an hour, meaning they sang the church hymns and the Christmas carols in the several languages, and they would be given an apple, an orange, some little memento, and go to the next house rather quickly. So that in Kuithluk, my wife's village, 50 years ago, the whole village received the star every night for 3 nights because the village was smaller and the feasting was much less. But in the last 50 years, the feasting has grown to full banquets. Hundreds of people cram into each house. People save fish and wildlife, game, ducks, and also buy turkeys and other store-bought foods. And they feed hundreds of people. Now, to do that, the star can only visit each house once. It takes longer for the star to visit each house. In some villages, there are two or even three stars, three choirs following them. Thousands of people are participating. They are singing ancient Byzantine and Greek hymns translated into Slavonic 1,000 years ago, followed by the same hymn translated and sung in their language, often followed by English. Singing that goes on anywhere from 15 minutes to 45. Then they sit down and eat, 5 to 10 people at a time, until the whole 100 people have eaten. In many houses, gifts are distributed, and then they go to the next house and do it again, day and night, as they would have in pre-contact times, feasting, singing, and exchanging gifts without any break, really, day after day, right through the night and on to the next. Now, I've discovered only more recently, you know, being an outsider more or less for the first 20 years, that the feasting, as understood by the Yupiks, is a continuation of the feasting from pre-Christian times. They are celebrating and giving thanks for the lives of the animals who have surrendered, given themselves to feed the human beings. And the gifts are given in memory of any members of that family who died in the previous year. So in this way, what is a sort of minor and only Western Russian or Ukrainian custom has come to Alaska and become a major social and even economic event, people spending good deals of money to prepare for the meal in memory of their departed friends, family, and loved ones, and sharing this with hundreds of friends and neighbors, not just from their own village, but as it was in pre-contact times, from neighboring villages as well.
Now, Paul, in my understanding then, that would be partially traditional life.
Oh, it's right? Essential. You know, I think of people look at whaling, traditional whaling communities, and the bringing in of bowhead and barrow. And one of the things that, you know, by contrast is, for example, you avoid conflict during the time of whaling season, and you see a dramatic change in behavior Hmong people. You don't speak in a mean way. You, the whaling people will slow down because they want the whale to realize that you're a peaceful community, you're a quiet community. Your disposition is understood by the tribe of people who are whale, and they are vital to the village. And when I try to describe the disposition, it's something like a liturgy, atonement, Thanksgiving, Christmas, confessional. People will often confess to one another during that time. And it is a fundamentally different community for that time. And then, you know, after the season is over, I would like to say, well, it changes the community permanently. But no, you know, after that, it's like, well, we were raised to not like your kids, you know, and, you know, all the shortcomings of human behavior, which have perhaps been suppressed by this sort of, like a cork by this, sort of reemerges. But at the end of it, it's the fabric, it is the religious, spiritual, cultural fabric that then holds a community together as it survives sort of all the vicissitudes of the monetary income and personal income and personal success and individualism that is pushing at us in such difficult ways.
This is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing God in Alaska. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Welcome to the show, Jay. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing just fine. Well, I was really interested to see the way that the Orthodox priests have been sugarcoated as far as what they did over the in the Aleut cultures. Now, I mean, all I have for reference is, you know, my family's from Kodiak, and I've heard all the stories. And quite frankly, you know, they weren't the one that they were enablers. And they participated in and did every part of the destruction of the culture.
And Father Michael, would you like to address that?
Well, I don't know exactly what particularly the caller has in mind, but we do know that the earliest missionaries, including especially St. Herman, who the Aleuts venerated as a saint and whose veneration then led to his canonization in Kodiak in 1970, considered the monks to be their defenders and the ones who spoke up on behalf of them when the Russian traders were violating their rights and enslaving them. We also know that the first Aleut school, the first bilingual school in the state, was begun by Orthodox clergy in 1804 in Kodiak. Father Gideon, who came as the Tsar's personal representative and father confessor, learned the Aleutic language, devised an alphabet for it, and opened a school in Kodiak where over 100 Aleutic kids were learning to read and write their own language, sang the Lord's Prayer at liturgy in the Kodiak Church in the Aleutic language beginning in 1806. And that school was continued well into the 1840s by Sophie Vlasov, a local Aleutic woman, and her husband, together with Father Homan over at Spruce Island. We know that the first books published in any native Alaskan language were printed for Kodiak Aleutic in the 1840s, and that the church sent a man who was never actually ordained, Ilya Tishinov, to learn the language again and to, using the earlier alphabet, the first primer, the first catechism, the first gospel, which was bilingual both in Russian and in Aleut, was published for Kodiak Aleutics in 1849. So there may be individuals in the 20th century to whom the caller is referring, but certainly according to the early history and all the records, the letters, the diaries, the reports, the monks were put under house arrest because they were in such opposition to Baranov and his henchmen. So we know from the earliest points of contact, there was great solidarity between the church, the monks, the missionaries, the clergy, and the Aleutic people in opposition to the Russian-American company that was really a dictatorship run by Alexander Baranov until 1818.
Jay, does that answer your question?
Well, you know, that the victors write the history, but there's always oral history. So, you know, that it's sort of like I see the, you know, the culture is sort of like the battered wife syndrome, you know.
Oh, I agree with you. Poor Kodiak Aleutic culture has really undergone tremendous pressure, and I would say even persecution, in the last 100 years.
And
well,
how
know,
so?
I can't say anything because my relatives were some of the ones doing the persecution. So, I do understand, you know, and I do understand the culture, and I, you know, like I say, I've heard the stories.
Well, you know, just to fill you in, I was actually brought to Alaska by Kodiak Aleutics. It was their idea, and it was their initiative. They were running Aleut School, as they called it, in Akiak and Old Harbor well into the 20th century. In other words, those books that I just mentioned were still being used, and kids were still being taught to read and write in their own language well into the 20th century, taught by teachers who were educated at the Unalaska Seminary. And then that seminary closed in 1918 because the funds were cut off following the Bolshevik revolution in Russia. The funds that helped support those schools and pay those teachers' salaries were cut off because of the communist takeover. And so there were still elders who had graduated in the early 20th century who were around until the 1940s and 50s. They were dying out in Perryville, in King Cove, in Old Harbor in the 60s. And so the people in Old Harbor, concerned about the continuation of Aleut school, wrote to the bishop and asked for a teacher. And after several false starts, they wound up with me. The letter came to St. Vladimir Seminary in the New York suburbs, and I had always been fascinated with Native Americans and wanted to come to Alaska, and so I accepted the invitation. But I had no idea what they wanted me to do when I got there. They wanted Aleut school, but I didn't know what Aleut school was. And then little by little, it became obvious. They showed me the books. And I didn't speak Aleutic, of course, so I had to start learning from the elders. And by the end of the summer, when the kids could sing even a few short hymns in Slavonic, in Aleutic, and in English, the elders in Old Harbor came up to me and said, well, finally, Michael, you got it right. Because that's really what they wanted. They wanted that continuity, which, when I talked to the people my age, had been forcibly suppressed. I mean, I remember talking to Carl Christensen Sr. in particular, who said he went to school speaking only Aleutic in 1952. And he was the first kid to be spanked and whipped for being caught speaking his language in the BIA school. So, and after that, his younger siblings went to school trying to speak English because they didn't want to get spanked or whipped the way their older brother had. So we know that native languages were very deliberately attacked and suppressed, and the cultures virtually persecuted. But that comes much later, because otherwise there'd be no Aleutic language being spoken even now. If it had been suppressed 200 years ago, there'd be no living speakers already. But we still have elders, as you know, around Kodiak, who still speak the language, although they remember being ostracized, if not persecuted, for being caught speaking it in school.
How do you address the question, however, though, that, or the statement, rather, that learning the language and teaching the language is just a means of further instilling religious beliefs?
The Aleutic language or any language?
Or in general, yes.
You know, I think that's why I was just at Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania last week. I wanted to see this site, which is sort of the Auschwitz of boarding schools. The motto of that school was, kill the Indian, save the child. And by kill the Indian, they meant eradicate all vestiges of the language and culture, precisely because there was this fear that as long as the language persisted, the traditional beliefs and worldview would continue.
So how is that different within the Aleut then?
There was no attack on the language in the early history of Alaska. It came with after the transfer of Alaska to American rule.
Mm. Paul, did you have something to say there?
What? Just a couple of observations. One is that during that time, there was a dramatic decline in the population of Native peoples from the introduction of epidemic after epidemic. And the mission, the the Orthodox missionaries are a part of, they're brought over by this Russian company that if it operated today, they would all be subject to the RICO Act as an ongoing criminal enterprise. They practiced sex slavery, unpaid labor, murder, blackmail, extortion, a variety of things that were going on. And so it certainly wasn't a golden era during the Russian occupation at that time alone. At the same time, there were remarkably good people doing things. And I think that's a part of the story. I'm sure there were, the accounts are of Orthodox priests like any human organization that did not live up to the highest ideals of the church and were not functioning as representatives. And I have people who say the same thing about traditional shaman, that, we had some who essentially were using spiritual blackmail. If you don't give me this, then that child may die and whatnot. And they would then say, well, shamanism is evil because of those practices. And I said, well, then how do you account for some of the actions of some of these televangelists that I've caught? And what does that tell you about Christianity then? My sense of it is that probably historically a more balanced perspective would be, certainly there were some rough edges. And one of the questions is, how is it that the Orthodox faith lives alongside this amazingly, at times, brutal period in which hundreds, thousands, if I understand, they're taking entire shiploads of Aleut men and women and moving them at their pleasure and points of convenience from one place to the next. And apparently, the church continues during this era. And
well, I think they don't overlap. They overlap. This horrible era is exactly the 27 years of Alexander Baranov's rule. Exactly those years. And what Baranov was doing was blatantly illegal, and he would have been convicted as a criminal even in his own day, but his attitude was, there's no other law enforcement in Alaska but me. So when you have the greatest crook running the show, the missionaries were the only ones who had the courage to speak out against it.
Well, and now we're just getting into another realm of conversation, but like I said, this was just meant to inspire some more discourse amongst our listeners and the people of our community. This hour is already beginning to come to a close. Oh, it already has. I'd like to thank our guests today for volunteering their time and insight, both to Paul Antagak, the director and founder of Last School, and Father Michael Alexa of the Russian Orthodox Church. This show parallels the PBS series On God in America that begins Monday, October 11th on KAKM, Channel 7. Next week, October 13th on Hometown Alaska, we will finish our two-part series of God in Alaska with discussion around the history of the distribution of different religions around the state and where religion is at today. Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Thank you for listening. I'm Tika Ballas.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.